Welcome to Rock Talk, the Score.com podcast. My name is Justin Landon. Since we're 2 months into the show now, I figure I'd do some housekeeping this week before we start the show. First up, thanks so much for listening. The feedback's been great, but I'm always looking to do better, so please don't hesitate to drop me a note in the comments on the Tor.com site or email me personally at justin@staffersbookreview.com or hit me up on Twitter anytime at jdiddyesquire. I'll also point out the show is now available via RSS through all the various smartphone stores and even Tumblr. Check out the episode post for those addresses. If you've been listening from the beginning, you know that this just isn't a discussion show. Every month we'll be doing one episode of audio fiction from the Tor.com short story collection. Usually we'll do three discussion shows, then a fiction one, although this month it'll be four discussion shows due to our special Hugo chat last week. With all that out of the way, let's get on with this week's show. I was lucky enough to spend about 30 minutes with the author of the forthcoming novel, The Three, and one of South Africa's rising literary stars, Sarah Lotz. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is your first solo novel being published outside of South Africa, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I've published in the UK under different names, but it's my first one solo novel that's come out internationally.
Your other authors' novels that you've published, you co-authored under the name S.L. Gray with Lewis Greenberg, and that was the Downside series?
Yeah, that's there's three books that are out at the moment, and then we're just working on number four, which is a bit of a departure from us. And then I also write with my 22-year-old daughter, Savannah. We write a very trashy zombie series called Deadlands together under the name Lily Hurt.
And then you even have a trio of writers that you write with.
Yeah, we write Choose Your Own Erotica, which has been a bit of an experiment and an absolute blast. It's been great fun. But I hooked up with two other South African writers, Helen Moffat and Paige Nick, to do that one because I'm incapable of writing sex scenes, and basically those books are just basically sex.
So write the connective tissue, like you write the story in between and they write the sex?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like that. It was sort of my idea, but I knew I couldn't do it. So I asked them if they'd be interested in hooking up with me to do it. It's the wrong phrase, hooking up, but there you go. And so they were very keen. And I mean, and I think that's part of what collaboration is all about, is choosing the right collaborator. So I mean, I've been lucky working with Louis because he's a absolutely brilliant literary stylist, whereas I'm more of a commercial writer. So we balance each other out that way as well.
That's fantastic. Now, I've read The Mall, which is the first book that you did with him. And now I've read The Three. And I have to say, your work is exceedingly creepy.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah. And it's not really traditional horror. I wouldn't call it traditional horror, but it's just like this sort of modern sensibility of horror. I don't know. Do you recognize that what you do is sort of unique?
Well, thank you very much. But I mean, I certainly hope so. I mean, that's a huge compliment. But I think what Louis and I try to do, and what I try to do, is twist the everyday, twist reality. So I mean, for example, in The Mall, you've got your everyday setting. You know, I mean, who hasn't ever been to a mall? Doesn't matter where you live in the world, and just kind of put a sort of uncanny edge to it. You know, just twist it just slightly so that you have this very, very sort of common setting. And that's kind of the same with The Three as well, to a certain extent, is just warping the everyday.
Yeah, it's a very slight turn in The Three, particularly. The Mall has a real supernatural feel to it, but one of the greatest things about The Three that I thought was it could be supernatural, and that's certainly an interpretation you can put on it, but it's such a slight twist that it might not be, which is a wonderful paradigm.
Oh yeah, no, I love doing that. And I mean, that was very difficult to pull off, is the kind of where do you want to go with this story sort of aspect of it. Because I do think of myself as a horror author, but I think The Three does sort of kind of nudge and knock on the door of the thriller element as well. There was a slight clashing of genre there, which was great fun to play with. I mean, I love melding it genres. Why should a particular book just have to stay along one path? So yeah, that was terrific fun to do.
So the book's being published by Hodder and Stoughton in the UK and Little Brown here in the US. Anne Perry's your primary editor, I presume?
Oh yes, no, she's been absolutely amazing. I mean, she's really, really kicked my ass with this book. I mean, she was, her ideas were fantastic. She cleaned up a lot of the, I mean, the book that's out now is quite different to the original manuscript. I mean, there's quite a lot of trimming that was done, and she had some brilliant suggestions. I mean, she is like the dream editor. It's what the editor that every writer should have, really. She's got the same kind of imagination and the same drive and the same passion for it. I mean, she really, really, really helped me out. She made me a better author.
Well, and if I read the story correctly, you sold the three to Anne based on a 30-page partial?
Yes. Gosh, that was extraordinary, because at the time, I mean, I was just about scratching a living as a writer. But I mean, really, it was a case of sort of, you know, the last week of the month was noodles and, you know, a real struggle. And then I wrote the partial, and I wrote a synopsis, and I sent it to my agent and said, what do you think? And he said, oh, this looks quite good. And he sent it out. And then I got a phone call from him saying, we just got an offer. And I couldn't believe it. I was absolutely gobsmacked. I was so stunned. I literally put the phone down, went over next door to where my nan lives, my 86-year-old nan, got her to pour me a drink. And then I sat and worked out how long I could live on the money and carry on writing for down to the last day. It's a bit pathetic, but there you go.
And when
was
that?
It changed my life.
What year was that?
Gosh. So it wasn't last year. It was the year before. What's that? Is that 2012?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's 2012. Yeah.
So you had already been working with Anne a little bit through Jurassic London. Is that right? Is that about the same time that Pandemonium came out?
Oh, yeah. No, I'd done a couple of short stories, one with Louie and then one a solo one. And so I had, so she was aware of my work. So I think that's why the manuscript or the partial didn't go right to the slush pile. So it really, really was a mixture of tremendous luck and having a great agent. And, you know, it's like the perfect storm of, and I think possibly the right kind of idea that, you know, I mean, I've always thought as a kid, I loved things like the Poseidon Adventure and the Towering Inferno and all that kind of stuff, those sort of big disaster sort of movies and things. And I really, really wanted to write one of those, and there didn't seem to be a great deal of that kind of fiction coming out. So I think perhaps it was that as well. It was like a confluence of all kinds of things.
Since we're sort of dancing around the three and what it's about, do you have a quick elevator pitch?
Basically, it's there's an unthinkable event, which is that four commercial airplanes crash on the same day, and there are only three survivors of the crashes. They're all children. And there's a woman on one of the planes who survives long enough to leave a message. And this message gets picked up by a fundamentalist pastor who thinks it could possibly be a sign that these children could be three of the horsemen of the apocalypse. And this sparks off all kinds of conspiracy theories and all kinds of, you know, kind of seeps into the political sphere. And, you know, like I really, really wanted to look at how a devastating event, you know, the kind of thing like that we saw that happened with 9/11, and how it kind of filters through into society and changes us and changes the way we act and we think.
And to somebody who's read it, that's exactly what it is. So,
oh, thank you.
we talked a little bit about the fact that you sold this as a partial, and I don't know what that sort of undersells is the fact that the narrative of this book is really unique. You begin the book with, you know, sort of a traditional, I don't know, 15-page third-person narration from the perspective of this woman on the plane who passes this message along. And once it crashes, the whole narrative structure of the book changes, and now it is a book within a book. And it becomes this, you know, this sensationalist reporter relating the story through a series of interview transcripts and sort of reconstructed events. And the fact that you sold this as a partial, what did the partial look like? I mean, was this, did you know that it was going to be structured this way from the beginning?
Well, when I initially started writing it, it was going to be a third person narrative all the way through. But it just wasn't working. It just seemed too heavy and too bogged down. And I really loved experimenting with all the different voices. So I wanted to write from the perspective of, say, a South African paramedic. I wanted to write from the perspective of a Japanese otaku girl and boy. And I wanted to really look at different voices. And so it really, that kind of Studs Terkel sort of first person narrative would only work in the context of that kind of sort of form. And I was very influenced by World War Z, which is a sort of the oral history sort of narrative. So I thought, let me have a go and see if I can make this sort of thing work. And because I was so interested in how the media takes, say, events like, you know, like plane crashes or those kind of things and really gets its teeth into them and just flogs them like a dead horse, I thought, let me do it this way. Let's have a journalist framing this and see what kind of spin she puts on it. And then I can also play with unreliable narration as well. You're never quite sure if what you're hearing or reading is the truth.
I think that's what stood out the most to me, because obviously I've read World War Z and other novels like that. Daniel H. Wilson's Robo Apocalypse does the same thing. And
yes.
But what's interesting about those books is the narrators are, I mean, you take them for truth, right? There's never really any question.
Yeah.
You never really call into question the authenticity of the narration that you're getting, where in this novel, I think you really do. And that's because you've framed this. It's not just somebody relating stories. It's actually a book within a book. And as we know, all books have a purpose.
Yeah, and it was also like there's things like, for example, there are perspectives from, say, Japanese characters. And because they're being put into an American book, I mean, it's been compiled by an American journalist. Obviously, I was dealing with translations. So I had to consider not only the original, how it would have been written or narrated, but how then the fictional American translator would translate it so it would sound authentically translated, if you see what I mean. So I did. There was a lot of stuff to really, really think about and try and get right, as well as just, you know, that like the, you know, the kind of Ted Turkle kind of style where you really wanted to come across as authentic. So, I mean, I worried about that a lot. I mean, because I've got sort of narrators who are from the Deep South, for example, right to sort of African refugees talking. So, you know, that kind of balance was tricky to pull off. And I really had to get many, many, many beta readers to read it to make sure that I was being authentic and not, you know, sort of treading on people's toes or pissing them off or, you know, just being disrespectful, really. So that was, yeah, it was a massive challenge. Massive.
Well, I live in Texas, where quite a bit.
Yeah.
quite a bit of your narrative is set, I guess.
Yes.
Certainly,
yes.
The religious aspects, most of that is set in Texas. So I enjoyed it. I'm actually pretty new to Texas, so I wasn't sure how it worked for me. So I'm not as deep into the culture down here as some folks are, but it worked for me. So, and one of the things I enjoyed with the Japanese perspectives was you recreated ASCII art, which I thought was great in the book.
I love that. Yeah, I love all of that. I'm a massive geek, so I adore all that kind of stuff. So it was. I mean, I think quite a lot of it actually got cut out, which we're going to use for some kind of extra material stuff, because I really did go overboard on quite a lot of stuff, and quite rightly pulled me back and kind of gave me a slap on the wrist and said, you know, control yourself. This is cool, but it's too much.
That's what editors are for. So.
I know.
One of the neatest things about this book, and this is something kind of for the listeners that unfortunately they'll probably never get a chance to hold, but I have an advanced review copy of this book, and it is like one of the sleekest advanced review copies ever. It's all black, and you know the pages, the end pages are all black, so it looks like a little black box, which is
yeah. Of course, I mean black boxes aren't actually black, but I mean I love that. I mean I think what they've done is just Hodder are amazing. I mean how they've it's beautiful. It's beautiful what they've done there. I mean, I'm really quite blown away by it all.
One of the key components in this novel, obviously, is the fear that's engendered by airplanes. You know, among all the means of travel that we employ as humans, air travel is pretty much the safest. I mean, it has like the lowest death rate, you know, on a percentage rate. Certainly far safer than driving a car. And yet a huge number of us are absolutely horrified by it. Do you, as somebody who's now written a book about the horror of airplanes, why is that? Why are we so scared of them?
I think it's a couple of reasons. I mean, because I'm actually flight phobic, so I've thought about this long and hard as well. I mean, part of it is that, you know, you've got absolutely no control. And I do think that some of us who are flight phobic are control freaks. I mean, like if you're in a car, you can chat to the driver and just say, you know, slow down or watch that or whatever. When you're on a plane, you're entirely at the whim of, you know, the captain, the crew, the, you know, has the maintenance crew done their job today, or have they left a little stray piece of tape over a duck somewhere, you know, that kind of thing. So you start, so you're out, that's all out of your control. I did read this really fascinating study that said that part of the reason why we are flight phobic, or some of us are, is because we can't see the captain's face. Whereas we can, say, in a potentially in a bus or a taxi or a car. So we can see that sort of, oh no, we're about to crash, or oh, it's all going fine. So, you know, maybe we should have like kind of dedicated captain channels, captain's face channels on the entertainment system or something. I don't know. It's crazy. But you know, there's, as well as it can be linked to claustrophobia, or some people think it's linked to a fear of vomiting, the fear that you're kind of being trapped in this environment and, you know, you can't get out. So, yeah, or fear of dying with strangers as well.
The pilot face thing kind of resonates with me. I've found that, you know, there are some airlines where the pilot will sort of stand there next to the flight attendant as you get on the plane. And I think that works pretty well, you know, seeing that there is an actual pilot. It is an actual human being.
You mean not like one of those blow up ones, like an airplane, like that movie Airplane with a blow up kind of. That's what I picture when I'm in a plane. But I mean, I spoke to loads of pilots when I was doing the research, and without exception, they were brilliant. They were all amazing. They are the sort of people you would follow in an apocalypse style situation. You know, like calm, controlled. We're not, you know, you knew they wouldn't get flustered. But then I also did hear some quite scary stories as well from them. But they are really, I mean, that kind of helped, hearing that kind of thing. But then when you start doing the research into the crashes, you know, over the decades, it is absolutely scary shitless as well.
Yeah, no doubt. And I hate to even mention Flight 370 because it's oddly timed, of course. But one of the interesting things I heard in that whole story is sort of the nature that, like, yeah, you know, sometimes pilots, you know, they put on autopilot and they kind of just check out for a while, which I thought was one of the interesting stories, which is sort of scary too, right? The notion of autopilot.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that whole thing happening was, I mean, I've got so many emails from people asking me what I think has gone on with that kind of situation. I mean, how would I? I'm not an expert, but because I've happened to written a book about planes crashing and disappearing, yeah, I have had several emails or calls from people wanting my opinion on what happened there.
You must know. Right?
Oh yeah, no, I know. I've got it all. I know the facts. Yeah, totally. No, but I think what I found most, I mean, because the thing is, when you're really researching about air crashes, etc., then you start to also read about the survivors and the people who have lost people, and that really, you are going into really, really upsetting, you know, sort of territory there. So I did get really upset quite a lot of the time doing some of this. And I mean, some of what I was doing was reading the transcripts of the last minutes of planes that have gone down, that they, you know, that were on the CVR recorder. There, if you really want, if you you can pick up some of them on YouTube, which is absolutely horrific. That I found really disturbing, and I actually urge people not to do that ever, especially if you ever want to get on a plane again, or a loved one to go on a plane. It's terrifying.
Sarah,
I'm getting myself in a state now.
that was a totally classic case of telling somebody not to do something, which of course they will then immediately
go
do.
No, it's really, really upsetting. It is. It's oi, 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 oi. Yeah, I really, really feel for all the family of the people that are lost. So, oi.
Well, yeah, you talk about that a little bit in the book, certainly, and I think that there's a unique aspect to airplane crashes that's different from other sorts, and it's that there's that group mentality to it, that when you lose somebody in an airplane, it's not just you or just, you know, four families in a car wreck. It's 200 or 300 families that are affected, and the way that group dynamic exists after the fact is, you know, not dissimilar. It's more on scale of a major disaster, like, you know, Hurricane Katrina or 9/11. I mean, when you talk about, you know, death scales and the group of families that are involved in the mourning.
Yeah, no, that was I think it's Paul, one of my narrators, Paul Craddock. He loses his twin brother and his sister-in-law, and he becomes the guardian of his niece. And that was very important, that this was one of the crashes that happened, and it happened in, it was a British airplane. And so he does become part of a support group. And, you know, so you do, in the book, you hear from the other members of the support group who give a perspective on him and how he's coping as well as how they're coping with the loss. And yeah, like, I mean, like I was saying, it was a lot of the information and writing was from reading accounts of people who had lost loved ones in these disasters. I mean, one of the most tragic things I read was a woman who she did have to get someone before she could even like look at a television or read a book to check that there was nothing that either referenced an airplane or had a crash in it or even had a death in it. I mean, it affected her for years afterwards. So that's what I was trying to sort of touch on as well. It's not just the kind of sensationalist aspect, so there's also a personal aspect to it as well, to the horror of it, really.
Hmm. The other thing in the novel that I think you really use to create fear in the reader, and it's interesting because it's not something I think that we usually use or manipulate to invoke fear, but I think you do it incredibly well, and that's functionally religious fervor. And I don't, it's not just religious fervor. I mean, I think that's the form that you use to manifest it. But for me as a reader, it was almost like the fear of the power of groupthink or the power of a zeitgeist. You know, the reaction I felt wasn't so much specific that I'm scared of, you know, Bible thumping Southerners, but I'm scared of any movement that has the power to move people that way.
Yeah, no, that is what I was trying to get at. But at the time, I mean, when I was writing it, it was 2012. I mean, we had the obviously an election year, and there was that kind of feeling of what if, for example, the Tea Party did manage to have to get in, whether Mitt Romney got in, what could possibly, you know, spin off from there. So I think that what I was trying to do as well was show that, because much as I am not averse to religion, now because of course I'm not, but I am frightened of hate mongering, because it's and that to me is where at the end of the, well, I can't really tell you about the end of the book, can I? Because it's going to be a massive spoiler. But I think there's certain aspects of religious fundamentalism that do involve hatred, and they involve that as you say, that group sort of mentality, and that group mentality has to have something to fear and has to have something to rail against. And generally, it tends to be for example, hatred of the other, hatred of gay people, for example, and that is kind of what I'm looking at in the book as well. It's not just fear, it's how fear can turn to paranoia and then it can turn to hatred. And that, to me, is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, and I think that what makes that so powerful, I mean, and I'll be interested to see the response to this as people get in here and read this and it gets out there into the wider world. And you get some devoutly religious people reading it and to see how if they can see beyond that, you know, because obviously you could read it in one way and say, you know, Sarah Lotz is trying to make a point about Christianity, and I don't really think that's what you're trying to do at all. What you're really trying to do is make a larger point, but it's always interesting to see how readers will respond to that.
Oh, no, I'm expecting an awful lot of flack. I mean, I am. I mean, I knew I would be. It was one way the story could go. It could have gone in a number of different ways, and it just seemed to me this is the most logical way in which the story seemed to move itself along. And especially, I mean, at the time I had been reading quite a lot into sort of how the religious right was influencing politics. And I did think, well, what if you did have enough proof? What if you thought you had enough proof that, for example, prophecy theory would come true, that the rapture was going to happen? What if enough people, if there was a critical mass, believed in this, I mean, and fundamentally believed in it, you know, then you do have the perfect storm and, you know, pretty much anything could happen. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm expecting, of course I am, I mean, a bit of a backlash there. So I'm preparing myself for it. And I mean, I know the style the book is written as well isn't going to appeal to everyone, but I, you know, I think sometimes, you know, you can't always play it safe. It's, the book was written how I felt it should be written. The content was written how I wanted it to be. And I took some chances there, and we'll see what happens. And I mean, from the reading that I've done, I've read from both sides. I mean, I haven't just read sort of, you know, sort of nonfiction political sort of perhaps left-leaning sort of books. I've also read from the right as well. I mean, I read all of a lot of stuff about prophecy theory written from people who truly believe in it. And it's pretty powerful stuff. And I have people who absolutely believe in this, and they happen to have a lot of power, and they have to have a lot of influence, and they have to have a lot of cash, then, you know, that's what you're going to get. And I mean, a lot of these people do. The big business churches, you know, I mean, they're big business. A lot of influence, a lot of sway, a lot of people. And yeah, I do, but, you know, in some way, I'm almost envious of people who believe in something with such fervor, because it must be in a lot of ways quite freeing, but most of me does find it quite terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you watch any of Joel Osteen on television, perhaps, during any of this?
No.
Well, Joel Osteen is a super preacher. He's based at just outside of Houston here in Texas, and he's on every Sunday morning, and it's basically a football arena that he preaches in.
Yeah.
It seats, you know, 100,000 people. It's incredible. And I will tell you, I am not a religious person, but if on Sunday he is on, I just happen to be flipping channels and he's on, I'll tell you what, I can't help but listen to him, because he is so powerfully charismatic that I want to watch him speak. It's incredible how good he is. It's like Bill Clinton. You could disagree with everything Bill Clinton says, but damned if you're not going to sit there and listen to it, you know? And that power of personality is incredible. And as you watch that audience react to every word he says, it's almost like, you know, a puppeteer pulling the strings. And it's amazing. Amazing to watch.
People want something to believe in. I mean, they do. I mean, we all do to a certain extent. I mean, when I was reading all the conspiracy theory sites and really delving down deep into it, there was something that I was reading where it started at like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was like, gosh, you know, what if they're right? It was so powerfully put and so powerfully kind of expressed that you do actually kind of feel yourself sort of, like you say, that kind of charismatic pull. And yeah, and I mean, I just remember, like, years ago, my grandfather died, my nan said to me, gosh, I wish with all my heart that I could believe I was going to see him again. And I've never forgotten that. So I do totally understand why people do believe. Which is great. But don't then, you know, sort of use your belief to sort of marginalize other people. And I really think that's kind of what the book's saying as well. So if I am being a bit preachy in the book, that's what I'm saying. It's like,
I think if you read my review that I wrote, I think that was absolutely my takeaway, was that one of the biggest themes of the book is that we have a group of people that are using their beliefs to justify essentially oppressing the weakest person you could imagine, the most vulnerable population you could imagine is being marginalized by this desire to be right, or this desire to believe in something. It's horrifying.
Yeah, no, totally. Sorry. Yeah. We went off on a bit of tangent there, didn't we?
We did. That's okay. That's what I am. That's fine. That's fine. So that's the three, which I hope everybody who's listening to this, you know, absolutely goes out and pre-orders a copy or orders a copy as soon as it hits the streets. When's its release date?
May 22nd.
May 22nd. Okay. That's what I didn't think it was out yet. So May 22nd, you know, I certainly hope everybody goes out and gets it. It's absolutely going to be one of the biggest books of the year, I hope. And you've already sold it into how many countries? Let's say like 18 countries or something like that?
I think it's 22 now, I think. Could be wrong.
But who's counting?
Yeah. I know. It's really, I can't believe it. I still can't believe it. I mean, it's completely done my head in. It's amazing.
No film deal yet, right?
There is actually. There's a television deal with Company Pictures. So they want to make a series, which would be terrific. Expensive, but terrific. So yeah, no, it's one of those things that you, as a writer, you just never expect it's going to happen to you. When it does, it's still, I do sometimes just walk around the house going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, really? 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 So yeah, It's incredible.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's interestingly, South Africa has had, in the last 5 years or so, just had a huge explosion of writers could have kind of jumped onto the scene, and not just writers, like other creatives as well. I'm thinking like Joey Hi-Fi, and you know certainly Lauren.
Oh yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, and certainly Lauren Bucus and others are.
Oh yeah.
Charlie Human, also South African, yes.
Yeah, Charlie Human. I mean Lauren really kind of blazed the way for everyone. I mean she was when she brought out Moxieland and Zoo City, and she just took off into the stratosphere. And she, what great thing about Lauren is she has always supported the writing community in South Africa and promotes everyone whenever she can. And that's, I think that's really made a giant difference as well. She's really sort of brought attention to the fact that, that there's a lot going on here and there's a lot of people with things to say. And especially in the spec fiction community, it's really taken off.
Why do you think we're seeing this in South Africa? And perhaps not other places. I mean, I'm sure part of it is the English speaking, but you know, certainly India, for example, has a huge English speaking population, and we're not seeing it from there.
I mean, like I said, I think it does just take like a small group of writers to kind of burst out. And I mean, obviously, Lauren's like a spectacular talent. I also think it's because our publishers are really kind of promoting us as well, whereas. You know, in decades past, that wasn't necessarily true. We've got a magnificent literary sort of background. But as far as the sort of genre community, now we've got excellent crime writers coming up. Why we're experimenting more with spec fiction now is as I think that, you know, this country is just absolutely, everything about this country is based on its politics and it's on the social fabric. I mean, you can't get anywhere without seeing it. I mean, it's and there's so many stories here. There's so many different communities and it's incredibly diverse. So there's endless stories to be told coming from here that, you know, other places would never have heard about. So I suppose it's that. We've got a huge creative sort of pool to draw from, which might be partly the reason.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I'm really excited about with it is that, you know, when I read Zoo City by Lauren, it was the fact that it was set, you know, in Johannesburg, and you have in your book, you know, scenes where the planes crashed in South Africa, and I think that's really important that we're seeing these books come out with settings that are not London and not New York and not Chicago, and I think that's going to make a big difference moving forward in sort of the internationalization of the genres.
I think that there's, I mean, at some point that a lot of publishers overseas were saying to South African writers, you know, don't set your stuff necessarily in South Africa as well, because that, you know, that used to be a kind of a cultural cringe where people didn't necessarily want to read about South Africa because they were, you know, potentially it was going to be about apartheid or, you know, things that people would rather not hear about, which is, you know, incredibly sad, but there you go. But now I think that we are more open to it. Cause there is, like I said, there is like a myriad of stories that are around and mythologies that are coming out of South Africa. I mean, I think if you look at Charlie Human's book, Apocalypse Now, it's got pretty much every South African mythology. There are hundreds in there. It's an incredibly creative book. So, yeah, I mean, it's really exciting what's happening.
I think part of that reaction to unexpected settings or the baggage that people would associate with a novel set in South Africa. We all wanted our science fiction and fantasy to be fun.
I mean, that's actually why me and Savannah, my daughter, wrote the Deadlands books, is because we just wanted to write something escapist and fun for South African readers set in a South African setting and, you know, accessible kind of gateway literature. But it also, there's quite a lot of social critique kind of seeded in there. There's always a way to do that without kind of ramming it down someone's thing across the board, whether it's coming out of South Africa or the UK or the States or Japan or wherever. Spec fiction definitely is, I think, a bit more of a political edge, but then it always has. It always has, really has.
On that same subject, sort of, and I read this short story that you wrote as S.L. Gray. We'll Always Be Here, which was published in the Lowest Heaven, from Jurassic
yes.
London, edited by Jared Sherin and your now editor at Hodder, Ann Perry. And I read that story and I absolutely loved it. I the Hugo Awards are being announced in about four and a half hours, and I nominated We Will Always Be Here for a Hugo Award.
You never, did you? Thank you so much. Wow.
I did. And it's an incredible story. And for those who haven't read The Lowest Heaven, if you haven't, you should. But the story that S.L. Gray wrote was about a couple of sisters that were sent off into space by their parents, ostensibly to save their lives. And sort of along the way, the society on the ship becomes structured around America's Next Top Model, which is...
which is just crazy,
but it's awesome. And I one of my favorite things in fiction is the melding, especially in the speculative fiction, is the melding of pop culture with science fiction and fantasy. Like, I love that. I just eat it up. Did you have a special affinity for America's Next Top Model?
Yeah, actually I do. I mean, I do watch it like with fascination and horror, because I think it's the most appalling show, but it exhibits the most incredible cruelty, actually. You know, here are these women basically being sort of berated for what they look like, et cetera, et cetera. And all the catchphrases and, you know, Tyra Banks is, I think, you know, I mean, part of me, I think she's incredible, but the other part is, I think she's completely insane. And there's such a strong mythology around that show as well. And in future generations, I don't see why that it couldn't seep through and become, you know, sort of the part of culture. Why not? Yeah. Why couldn't we all be like telling each other to be ugly pretties? And, you know, Tyra could be the kind of next great prophet for all we know.
There you go.
You heard it here first.
This should be the pitch line on the back of the three. Sarah Lotz thinks Tyra Banks is a prophet. I love it.
Yeah, gosh, I should probably have some coffee now or a drink.
Well,
wow.
So I've kept you now for about 40 minutes, so I won't keep you any longer, but I will say thank you for coming on. The Three is a magnificent novel, and so is a lot of your other work, and I hope that The Three is obviously already having some success, and I hope I'm sure the sales will back that up, but as people go out and buy The Three, I really hope they go out and pick up your other work as well under all of your various pseudonyms, because it's well worth reading, and we need more people writing like you in the field, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Justin, and thank you for letting me babble on.
This has been Rocket Talk.